tell me about this documentary. Obviously, I know you have the military background with you, but what was the inspiration to this?
You know, a lot of the inspiration really was, you know, my personal experience with reentry and also the experience of my soldiers. You know, because we felt like while we were overseas fighting, and I deployed to Afghanistan with the 82nd Airborne Division, and when we came back, there was just an amazing disconnect between what we were doing overseas and our service overseas, and then when you come back home to a population where it's literally, you know, it's 0.5% who has direct experience with the two longest wars in our nation's history. And so really what I wanted to do with this piece and what we wanted to do with this series was to highlight the stories, highlight the service, make sure that there was a sense of humanity behind these numbers. And particularly now, as we're coming to an end of combat operations and we're having tens of thousands of soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines who are going to be returning back to this country, I want people to know their names. I want people to know their stories. And so as we're having conversations about reentry and what can we do to support, that we actually have a human touch to it as well.
What was the most interesting story that will stay with you and that has stayed with you since you did the shooting?
Oh, God,
I know it's probably
hard
to put it into that.
Which one of your kids do you love the most?
I know. Not fair to say that to you. But are there any that maybe do stand out where you maybe want to see through to the end of their experience?
Well, you know, I think part of the beauty of all the stories is that each and every one of them in their own way are remarkable. But the thing I love about all of them is that they're all so ordinary. So whether you're talking about the transition of Star and Chris, who are a couple who were deployed, both at different times, both of them served in Afghanistan at different times and have to now figure out how exactly do we transition them with the family, because they have, you know, they have a 1-year-old daughter who now was both born throughout this process and now being raised with the process of having one or both parents were deployed. Or whether it's the story of Tammy, a double amputee who you know, had significant issues when she came back home, but is now a congresswoman. You know, representing a district in Illinois, and trying to make sure that veterans' issues aren't forgotten, both on the psychological aspect, but on the financial aspect. You know, whether it's someone like Andy Clark, who left combat and is now a contractor in Afghanistan. So for him, it's a very different environment because he's still able to kind of go back and still have the feeling of being deployed. But for his wife, she's basically like, you know, he's no longer a soldier, but I still don't see any difference between the deployment schedules. And so all of them are remarkable in their own ways and all the details and the delicacies of their story. But at the same time, the thing I love about all these stories is there are tens of thousands of people who have stories just like theirs. And that's really what we wanted to profile.
And you did talk to some Baltimore vets, correct?
Of course, yes. Yeah, so I mean, and I'm a very proud Baltimorean.
Of course.
And really what we, you know, what we tried to show is kind of the larger diversity of a veteran population. You know, Maryland's a very interesting state because, you know, because what people don't realize a lot about Maryland is the size of the veteran population here in the Bay State, here in our hometown. The work that a lot of veterans are doing, you know, within Baltimore, whether it be organizations like Team Rubicon, organizations like, you know, Operation Oliver, who are doing some really interesting work. And so, yes, we wanted to make sure that we profile, you know, the challenges, but also the real opportunities that veterans all over our city and state are actually doing.
Is the Veterans Affairs Administration and the process of being a vet in this country broken? And based upon your experience, what you found out through your stories, and then how do you think the country should go about fixing it?
You know, it is. One thing I see, I know so many people who work in the VA, both at the state and the federal level, and I have a tremendous amount of respect for them and the work that they do. But the truth is, anyone who says that the system is working perfectly fine right now has no idea what they're talking about. You know, we have far too many veterans who it takes way too long for them to be able to see doctors and receive treatment. We saw what's happening in Phoenix now. We see what's happening in Colorado. And the heartbreaking thing about it for veterans is, while the nation is now learning about what happened in Phoenix, where 40 people die, waiting to see a doctor. Think about that. Waiting to see a doctor that 40 people die. But for the veterans community, these are not new stories to us. You know, it should come as you know, with the veterans community, the fact that we've had, you know, on average, and these are the VA numbers, 22 people a day who commit suicide. Mm-hmm. 22 veterans a day commit suicide. You know, we know for a fact that people in our VAs are working extraordinarily hard to address these issues. And we also know that they just do not have the resources right now to be able to address it. No one expected these wars to last this long.
Right.
You know, I was in a, you know, we've been doing these town hall settings in cities all over the country. We're actually doing the one in Baltimore, you know, tonight, Wednesday night. And I was in San Antonio with a whole collection, Las Vegas, with a whole collection of military families and military personnel and that kind of thing. There were about 300 people, more or less, in the room. And I asked them, how many of you expected, if I would have said 10 years ago, that these wars would still be going on? Three hands went up. Mm-hmm. Out of the close to 300 people in that room, three hands went up. Said, if I would have told you 10 years ago, these wars would still be going on. So I think what we have right now is a system that is trying to keep pace. But when you look at the numbers and you look at the needs, it's having a very difficult time doing so.
Did we learn, and what lessons have we as society and as government learned about how to handle vets, even dating back to World War II? Because we hear so much about they're forgotten.
Yeah. And I think part of the idea and the motivation behind this was making sure that it's not even just Iraq and Afghanistan vets like us who are not forgotten, but it's all the generations. You know, frankly, I think there should be a real sense still of embarrassment that our nation has about the way that Vietnam veterans were treated. You know, these are men and women who raised their hand because the country asked them to. You know, these are men and women, and at least in the case, especially in Vietnam, where many of them didn't even sign up and went over to serve. We as a nation have to make sure that we're not just responsible, but respectful of that and what that means, because the lion's share of veterans who I serve with, of you know, my soldiers, they weren't fighting for socio-political or socio-economic, you know, intellectual conversations. They were fighting for the people to the left and to the right of them. And I think there's a certain respect that has to come along with that. And one thing I think we wanted to take away, and we want people to take away from this, is as we're thinking about conflicts, not even just in conflicts past, but in conflicts future, when you make a decision to send troops overseas, when you make a decision to send, you know, to send men and women in harm's way to represent the values and the interest and the freedoms that our country offers, we need to make sure we understand what that means. We need to make sure we understand that this means a long-term commitment. We need to make sure that it means that just after the fighting and the bullets and everything stop fighting, that our men and women who raised their hand and served and put on that uniform have to have the supports in place when they come back home the same way that they had while they were overseas fighting. I think one of the people we followed, Congresswoman Tammy Duckworth, said it best when she said, when our nation needed us, we didn't ask them to wait. We went. We served and we fought. So why, when we come back home and we're looking for, you know, for the dues that we've earned, does our nation now ask us to wait?
How frustrated were the men and women you featured in your documentary with the process, and maybe with their acceptance or non-acceptance back into society?
I think there was a level of frustration, and because I think that people feel the sense of disconnect, where they feel like, you know, their service overseas is not understood by people who are back home, or where people can say thank you for your service and the conversation kind of ends there, without the second questions and the third questions that a lot of veterans were hoping that people would ask. But I think one thing that people also understand is there's a sense of frustration with the idea that everything dealing with the veterans community is all about PTSD and TBI and suicide rates and unemployment. These are real. And we could go on for hours talking about the issues and the things that we do need to fundamentally address and the structural issues that we have to address. But the truth is, that's not the whole story. I mean, you know, we have veterans who are coming back with extraordinary skill sets. We have veterans who are coming back with extraordinary gifts and things and missions that they still want to continue. We have veterans who are running VSOs, veteran service organizations, who are running for office, who are running businesses, who are in nonprofit worlds, who are in higher education, who are in media, who are doing so many different things. And I think there one thing that we're hoping as a larger community is that every story around veterans isn't just about our challenges, but that also they're about the opportunities, that this isn't just about looking at us as charities, but looking at us as investments.
What would be your one message, because you kind of just hit on it, for the American people and for people who might be watching, their takeaway from your documentary? But what about for the movers and shakers, the ones that make the decisions in this country?
I really want people to know our stories, because I think, you know, and I'm a quantitative thinker. I like numbers. I like data. I'm weird like that, I guess. but I also know that data sometimes can be used to numb, and data can sometimes be used to make people's eyes gloss over intentionally. When people hear what's going on with the veterans community and the opportunities that we can have to continue to serve, I don't want people just to simply know these numbers. I want them to know Bobby. I want them to know Stacy. I want them to know Latrice. I want them to know Andy. I want them to know Star. I want them to know all these veterans and all of our stories, so that when we're making policy decisions, when we're making decisions that affect long-term implications for our families and our communities, that we're not just making decisions based on numbers, but we're making decisions based on humanity.
Well, it's a three-part documentary. I know it starts to air next Tuesday on MPT at 8 o'clock.
Yes.
Thank you so much for joining us and for sharing your stories and telling us how you put the stories of all these military men and women together. We appreciate it.
Bless you, and it means the world to me, so thank you so much.